Welcome to the Epic Echo, a podcast designed to reflect the lives and voices of our community and hosted by the Eastern Panhandle Empowerment Center. The content of today's episode may be difficult or triggering for some listeners to hear. If you need support, please call our 24/7 helpline at 304-263-8292.
Welcome back to another episode of the Epic Echo. I'm your host, Brittany, and today we have a very special guest. Carrie, if you would like to introduce yourself.
All right, so my name is Carrie Smith. I am the same program coordinator for WVU Medicine in the East, which includes Jefferson and Berkeley Medical Center. I am also part of the Human Trafficking Task Force for West Virginia, brought on by your Katie Spriggs herself. And I do all the SANE, not all of them, I take call for the SANE exams in West Virginia, but I also do SANE for the state of Texas and the state of Pennsylvania for their rural hospitals for SANE examinations, forensic exams.
I didn't know that. So are you, I know you're like the director of the programs for Berkeley and Jefferson. So do you just do SANE exams in Texas and Pennsylvania, or are you in a managerial role there?
No, I just take call for their TeleSANE program for Texas A&M and Penn State Health, and do their, like in their rural hospitals where they don't have full-time staff or forensic nurses. I'll telehealth in and do those forensic exams for them. It's really, I see a big difference in Texas, because in Texas, most of the rural hospitals are down there on the border, like Uvalde and stuff. So I see a lot of human trafficking victims coming in. Now, I don't see the kids. We just deal with the adult and adolescent population, so anyone over the age of generally the 12, age of 12. But it's really opened my eyes to what human trafficking looks like in Texas versus what it looks like here in West Virginia, right?
Yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit about what that difference is like?
Sure. So in West Virginia, you know, people always watch the movies and stuff and think of human trafficking as like moving someone, kidnapping a teenager and taking them to China.
Yep.
And selling them on the black market, those type of things. But that's not at all what's happening in West Virginia or Texas per se. In West Virginia, it's more the familiar trafficking where, you know we have a huge drug problem here.
Yeah.
It's an epidemic. And we see families, parents selling their own children for, and it's usually for drug money,
right,
purposes. So that's what we see most here in West Virginia, or at least what I see most in the Berkeley County area. And from what I know, I'm pretty sure Berkeley County has the most human trafficking cases in the state right now, as far as
wow,
what we're doing. But then in Texas, I see it from an immigration point. So, you know, victims are crossing the border, coming into the United States, and they're being brought over, but they usually pay someone to help them. It's not necessarily a handler, but, you know, it's just like a guide, and it's usually come in. So one victim that I had, she crossed over, and she was with her husband and child, but they were separated once they crossed over, and she had to go with this different group, and the guides told her, they said, you know, we'll carry your baggage for you. And she was like, no, I've got it myself. And they kept insisting that, no, we're going to carry your baggage for you. So what that meant is they carried her baggage, because she said they walked all the time. She said they slept mostly at night, or I'm sorry, during the day, but at night, but they would walk and they would stop at like these watering places to get water and stuff like that. But then eventually after a couple of days in, they said, you know, now you need to do us a favor because we carried your bag. So now you owe us.
Mm.
That's where she was sexually assaulted. And then she came in to the hospital. But the sad part is, and I'm not saying this is all the cases, but the cases that I've worked with is immigration has already come and taken custody of the victim. So they're in U.S. Customs or the border place right there and awaiting to get sent back to where she came from. But before that, she comes and gets a sexual assault exam. We collect the evidence. But like in West Virginia here, after an exam, we can offer the STI prophylaxis and the
right,
HIV prevention, all that kind of stuff, where with her, I could only offer her what we could do there in the hospital, but there was no HIV prophylaxis because she was going back in a few days and there was going to be a follow-up. So that's a whole nother part of it that I thought about that I was like, this is crazy. What's happening. So I see it two different scenarios in different states, how it's playing out.
So they each have their different barriers.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, that I can't even imagine trying to do something down there just because it is harder, especially around their immigration laws and everything. And it's a different culture down there as well.
Right. Yeah. And it's a lot of politics. I'm not going to get into the politics of what I feel is right or wrong or one side or the other. I'm there to do what I always do, and that's provide medical care and do it in a patient-centered, trauma-informed way. And doing that with victims who are usually handcuffed, you know, to the bed. And I'm like, this is insane to me. And then to have to say my goodbyes and I know there will be no follow-up whatsoever. None.
Yeah. That's hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whereas in West Virginia, when I see victims, especially for human trafficking, I know that, you know, we have connections here. So we're going to be able to follow up. You know, we go to our MDIT meetings and we hear about children every month. So there, that way no kid is kind of slipped through the cracks. Everybody's accounted for.
Do you want to explain a little bit about, like, briefly what an MDIT meeting is? Because I'm sure a lot of people that would listen to this podcast probably wouldn't know.
Sure. So the MDIT stands for Multidisciplinary Investigative Team. And each county in the state has one. They're required to have one. I sit on Berkeley's and Jefferson's, and sometimes I sit on Morgan's, depending if we have a case over there. But it's really meeting with, so medical comes, myself, the prosecutor comes, the law enforcement agency. So we have in Berkeley County, it's, you know, city, Martinsburg City, Berkeley County Sheriff's, and the state police all come. The CAC, the Child Advocacy Center, their advocates come. Usually someone from the Eastern Panhandle Empowerment Center is there as well. And we all kind of, and CPS comes also. And we all kind of collaborate together over each kid. And, you know, we go through each child on our list every single month to see where they are in their process. You know, has there been an investigation? Have they gotten a medical exam? Have they gotten CAC advocacy? Just so that we make sure every agency is doing their part.
Yeah. Thank you for that. So I wasn't aware that you could do SANE exams virtually. That's really cool that they'd have that in other states. Because I'm not, do they have that in West Virginia?
So here's the funny thing. No one in West Virginia is doing it right now. We've done a couple of mock exams, like on the fly, because it was just happened, the circumstance. But it was not formalized by any means. Although they did just pass that new legislation that they want to have SANEs by June of this year, they want to have SANE access in every single hospital in the state of West Virginia. Now, the
caveat would be amazing.
They can have a transfer agreement with another hospital, which would be ours or Morgantown's, or they can do it via telehealth, a telesane. So I would love to see that come to West Virginia because we're the perfect state for this. We have so many rural hospitals and so many rural areas that we could get into. And that's the way healthcare is going. You know, it's moving towards the telemedicine right now.
Right.
So telesane is right there with it. And I think it's an advantage because it works different in different states. So for instance, in Pennsylvania, when I do a telesane exam, the person that is performing the exam in person is actually SANE trained. So they kind of have a background in it.
That's right? Good.
Whereas Texas, it's an ER nurse that has not had SANE training. So I'm basically doing the entire exam. They're just using their hands in the exam and following it. So two different scenarios. Pennsylvania, I would not be called for testimony. Texas, since I'm, you know, pretty much the person that's doing the exam, I can be called to testify in Texas for those cases. So two different ways to look at it. I think West Virginia would probably benefit from, you know, an ER nurse that isn't SANE trained yet, because that's one of our biggest holdbacks too in the state, is trying to get nurses trained and SANE and then getting them off the clinicals, because it's a big clinical portion to, after your SANE training, until you can actually start practicing. So a lot of barriers in the state.
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you about the fact that if we could do telehealth in the rural areas. Because for someone who lives in like Jefferson or Berkeley County, I feel like we don't get the full grasp of what West Virginia actually looks like. And until I started this job, I hadn't been to the middle of West Virginia or lower West Virginia. And once I started going down there, I was like, this is very rural. There's not a lot down here. There's places that are like, it's 40 minutes to the next closest gas station, or there's one grocery store that feeds 10 towns. And like, it is very open and there's not much there. And some people don't have cars. Like, West Virginia is historically a poorer state, and they might not be able to get to one of the more metropolitan areas like Jefferson or Berkeley, where you have, or Morgantown even, that has sane trained examiners. I would like to know what leads you to this, what led you to this line of work, and if you feel comfortable sharing that.
Sure. So back in 2015, they offered a training through West Virginia Frist. It was a free training. So, that catches everybody's eye. It was for nurses. And I didn't even know what a forensic nurse or a SANE was at that point. And so I was in maternal health and I was like, this sounds interesting. What is this? Tell me more. And they told me, and to be honest, at the time, my oldest had just started college. And I was like, well, this might be an extra side gig for some extra money while she's in college. Let me sign up and do it. So I took the training. Once I got into it, it was like a light bulb went off in my head that this is what I've been wanting to do my whole life. So I think it was important because everybody wants to find that job where they enjoy going to every day and wanting to stay. And my husband and I often talk about, he's like, what would you do if we won the lottery? He said, would you just quit work? And I look at him and he says, I know you would never just quit work. I said, no, I could never quit this line of work. I could give up other parts of my nursing, like, working on the floor and stuff. But as far as taking care of patients for forensics, and this is kind of like a program that we created here in the Panhandle, and it's still continuing to grow, I would never, never give it up. This is my passion. And all of my training since 2015 has just been geared towards forensics, whether it's human trafficking, strangulation, IPV, the danger assessment, all of those little things that go into our job, those are what all my certifications are in now. It's just, I want more and more.
Well, we're very thankful to have you here for
Yes.
sure. And you've definitely made a huge leeway in the road for discussing strangulation and everything, because a lot of people don't understand what it is and like the trainings that you have done, whether that be for law enforcement or local community members even, and the other sane and regular nursing examiners. Like it's been extremely impactful. Like I loved sitting through your training. I learned so much because I was like, I didn't even know half of this stuff. And the fact that you're able to learn it and then go out and train everyone, I think it's such a beneficial training for people to have.
It is, even for medical staff, for the providers to know to get those CTAs of the neck and to talk with our teenage population about the danger of
Yes.
strangulation, because we know that is part of that scene now. And when you start throwing out statistics, people's eyes light up and they're like, what? And I'm like, oh yeah, when you tell people that it's the leading cause of stroke for anyone under the age of 40 is
Yeah.
strangulation, that people are like, what? Wait a minute, what? And your risk of stroke and everything that goes into those trainings, I think it's just really important.
Yeah. Well, and there's a lot of stigma too around like what strangulation actually ensues, and the fact that when you tell them, like, first of all, it's a lot easier to die from it than you think it is, and it doesn't take nearly as long as you think it's going to take, and then it constitutes more than just hands around your neck. It's pressure on your chest or neck, period. It doesn't have to be someone actually strangling you as the typical way people see strangulation.
And it's not choking, that's
Right.
food caught in your mouth. But yeah, and so when you rephrase it sometimes when I'm doing an exam and I'll say, were you strangled? Most patients, no. And I'm like, well, let me ask you this. Did you have any pressure applied to your neck or chest? And they're like, oh, well, yeah, he put his hands there for a second. I'm like, oh, that's strangulation. Let's talk more about that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, we're very thankful to have you as our SANE nursing examiner, our lead SANE. And I'm sure other people would love to have you as well, but we want to keep
I'll be staying here. Don't
you.
worry.
So obviously, because we wanted to do this to talk about Human Trafficking Awareness Month and human trafficking in general, one of the main questions I wanted to know was, what does human trafficking awareness mean to you, and why
So
is it important?
it's January, right? It's Human Trafficking Awareness Month. But I'll tell you what, when Katie dragged me into the West Virginia State Human Trafficking Task Force. And we started going through, it was a train the trainer type of situation. So we were getting trained and we were learning about, you know, human trafficking in general. But I started to look at it more like, what does that mean for me and what I do? So I started doing a deep dive. And we didn't have any medical people on our team to like specifically train me and say, this is what we want you to talk about for human trafficking awareness. So I did a deep dive. I joined HEAL, which is a national network, and found out the statistics. And the statistics were 87.8% of trafficked victims come in contact with a healthcare provider while they're being trafficked.
Wow, that's really high.
That is high. And I was like, okay. Only 3% of those victims were actually, a report was ever made from healthcare provider. I was like, oh, what?
Yeah.
So this just tells us that statistically, we do not know how to look for it. And then we don't know how to respond to it if we see it and what we can do about it in the healthcare setting. Because there's multiple barriers, right? You know, anyone over the age of 18, as you know, with domestic violence,
right,
they can go back to those situations and we have to be able to respect that. But what can we do for them while they're with us in the facility? And those are the things. So I was like, okay, this is another passion now, and I'm going to shout this from the rooftops to all. So with Jefferson and Berkeley, because those two hospitals are kind of combined to make one under the same system,
right,
we're kind of treated as the same. So I went to the administration. I was like, these are the statistics. You know, I think this would be something we should really try and work towards gaining more knowledge on this. So we put together some trainings and we did lunch and learns. And then the hospital administration said, I want to make this mandatory education for all employees. You know, not only nurses, but physicians, registration, housekeeping, everybody, because everybody sees it. We all could recognize it.
Yeah.
And what are we going to do with that? So that was our goal for last year, for 2023, was to make mandatory education. Everybody got it. It was part of our yearly education. We did some modules. So I do still continue to talk about that. And I've been to some other hospitals throughout the state to talk about, you know, what human trafficking looks like in the healthcare setting more specifically, because we can all get the basic human trafficking training, what it is, sex trafficking,
right,
labor trafficking.
Right.
These are the definitions, that type of thing. But I found out people would get that education, but then they were like, but what do I do with that? What do you want me to do? And so I was like, okay, we need to think of a response and how are we going to respond in the healthcare setting? So that, of course, prompted us to our initiative for 2024, which is
the
Red Dot Program.
I absolutely want to talk about that. I would love for you to explain just a little bit about the program, what it entails, and then I want to talk a little bit about how the pilot program is going at Jefferson currently.
Okay, so not to give too much away, because you know, keep some things a
absolutely
little secretive, but so a friend of mine, Sarah Guthrie, who is the department manager director for behavior health at Berkeley Medical, and one of her colleagues, Nicole, came to me and they were like, hey, we saw this thing out in the, you know, we saw it somewhere and it looks like a really cool idea. Is there something we could do with this? And they sent me a picture of signage with little red stickers and, you know, basically said, you know, put a dot on your urine cup, that thing. And I was like, okay, let's think about this. How can we make this work? And Nicole actually is in grad school and she wanted to write a paper about it, a paper. So I was like, okay, we're going to think about this. So I was like, first of all, let's clean up this signage, because somebody basically writing on a letterhead, do this, it just, that doesn't look appealing. So I contacted Melissa, who's with you all. And I said, hey, this is what we want to do. You are all into that graphic design and designing all of those pages and everything. I'm like, help me out a little bit. So she did a mock one for me and I sent that to our marketing team. And I was like, this is what I want to do. So basically it's just signage that says, you know, and it's in our bathrooms in the ER and OB. It says, if you feel like you have been abused, human trafficked, you know, asked to do things that you're not comfortable doing for sex or labor, any of those types of things, you can reach out to us. So one way is to use the red sticker to let us know. And then the other way is, I told Melissa, I said, I want some QR codes on this verbiage, you know, because some patients might not want to reach out to us at the time, and that's okay.
Right.
So we put QR codes, one's for human trafficking, one's for abuse, sexual assault type of thing. And the victim or the patient can scan those QR codes. But here's the greatest thing is when they scan those QR codes, it'll give you the national hotline, but it also gives the empowerment centers information.
Yes.
It gives Ranson police departments information. Nice. So it gives local resources that you can use right here and right now to get help.
Yeah.
If you don't want to do the whole red dot type of thing. And then the biggest thing for healthcare with human trafficking is step number one is separate the victim, separate right. the patient, you know, from whoever they're with. So basically what our red dot campaign is, it's alerting us that we need to separate the patient, because every patient that comes to the ER or OB, when they're first triaged, we go through the questions. We ask, you know, do you feel safe at home? Have you been abused? And most of the time, patients are with somebody else, and the likelihood that that patient, right. that's the person that's abusing them, is with them. So very rarely does someone actually say, no, I don't feel safe. And we know that, you know, so
yeah.
this is just
yeah.
a way for us to try and catch those people. We call it, we call it the red dot campaign, but it's like a self-disclosure type of thing, you know, where they can come to us and reach out for help without making a scene or causing any kind of disturbance with whoever's with them. So that's what we're trying to get at. And, you know, if we get one person over this next year,
right.
that is a win for us. But we have had success already. So we started it at Jefferson because Jefferson is the smaller hospital, and we made up policies and procedures, and we wrote all those up. And we're like, this is what we did training with ER staff, and we did training with OB, because, you know, if you're pregnant and you come in, you kind of bypass the ER and you come straight
right.
to OB. And we're trying to think of ways to catch everyone as they point of entries. But we hung this signage in the bathrooms, and all of a sudden lab came to me and they were like, we saw your signage, we want it. Because victim,
oh.
you know, sometimes patients come in and they just for a sample of blood or something, and they don't necessarily come to the ER, and we're like, okay, great idea. So we gave lab access to it with their bathroom. So more people are seeing it and thinking of more creative ideas and ways to use it, which is a positive. So
yeah.
we started at Jefferson back in October. You know, it kind of took us almost till the 1st of November to actually get it off the ground. And then we figure, what better time than January for human trafficking awareness?
Absolutely.
To Berkeley. So we had a big meeting right before the holidays. And of course, everybody at Berkeley's on board. So that's what all of January, we're training staff at Berkeley. On this signage, and then we're hanging it at Berkeley.
That's amazing. So you're very busy.
Very busy, yes. But that's
doing all
the
amazing
my
things.
ADHD brain.
I was curious how staff responded to it, because I know that sometimes staff is willing to do the extra things, but also they have a million and one jobs already. So did you have any pushback from staff?
I didn't have pushback, but I did have lots of questions of like, all these crazy scenarios. And I finally had to say, you're right. These things that you're can happen. But let's go, because they one of them were like, well, what if we miss it? What if it, you know, it goes on and we miss it? And we had to, okay, everybody just stop for a second. Okay. Let's look at the larger picture.
Right.
If we catch one patient with this, it's going to be a win. Are we going to miss some patients? Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, let's not be unrealistic here, but for the most part, you know, all the situations that you're throwing at me are very extreme situations that I've never even seen happen in healthcare. But I know you think about them, you know, because we all think about that
right.
crazy situation. But if it happens, it happens. It's out of our control. We're
yeah.
doing the best that we can with this. So after saying that, a lot of stuff was like, okay. You know, because some people were like, but we shouldn't even tell anybody about this program, because it's not a secret.
Right.
You know,
right.
We have verbiage in male and female bathrooms.
Right.
So it's not like somebody, the abuser is probably going to see the signage if they go to the bathroom. Yes.
Right.
But I'm not going to let that, I can't think of a way to make it so secretive. It's just, it is what it is. This is us trying to make a difference, trying to make it more accessible to patients.
I think it's important that you brought up the fact that it's in both bathrooms, because one, when a lot of people think about human trafficking, they think about women. And obviously it happens to both men and women for human trafficking, sexual abuse, domestic violence. So it's important to have it in both bathrooms. I can see a little bit of the, well, what if the abuser, either gender, uses the bathroom and then they seize it? That would be an unfortunate circumstance, and they would probably very quickly leave with the person that's being trafficked. But for the scenarios where it's the trafficker that goes to the bathroom and they need assistance, and even if it's not reaching out to nursing staff while they're there, maybe it's okay, I'm not ready yet, but at some point they have it pulled up on their phone and they have those numbers for Epic or the police department. I didn't even know it was part of that. It's really cool that you guys added the local police departments for each hospital, because that's, I think that's important. A lot of people don't necessarily want to report and they might never use it, but for the one that wants it in that moment, it's right there and accessible to them. So that's really cool that you guys added that in as well.
Right. Because we all know, you know, over the age of 18, you can decide what you want. You do not have to involve law enforcement.
Right.
And that's not my position to call law enforcement if you come to me and ask for help. Not at all. The goal of this is to, if someone asks for help, is to offer them resources. And who's our resource? The Eastern Panhandle Empowerment Center.
Right.
So it's a way of us getting you all in to see the patients. And you're not calling the police. Nobody's calling law enforcement unless you want us to. But it's a way for us to offer resources so that maybe the next time you're ready to make a change. And, you know, we're planting the seed. Let's start planting the seed. Because most victims of human trafficking, they don't trust law enforcement.
Right.
And I've come to find out they don't trust healthcare workers either. So, you know, I want to start to build that rapport of, I'm just here to help.
Yeah.
I'm not here to make decisions for you. I'm not here to cause a disturbance in your life. You know, that's the worst, because that's just going to make it unsafe for you.
Right.
You know, you have to decide when you're ready to leave these situations. But I can offer you resources. And one of the biggest things I teach with healthcare workers is, listen, these victims come in for an acute injury. They're not getting regular prenatal care if they're pregnant, or they're not getting, they don't see the dentist regularly like you and
right.
I do. They don't get their annual physicals done. So what does that tell us? So we're probably going to uncover a lot of health problems when we see them for that short period of time. But let's put on our empathy caps and look at this and say, we might not see this victim again for 5, 6, 7, 10 years.
Yeah.
Because they're probably going to go back to their perpetrator. But let's offer them all the health care we can while we have them for that short period of window. Maybe it's, you know, just checking their vital signs. Maybe it's giving them a vision screening. Maybe we're doing a pap smear right there on the fly. We're catching you up on your immunizations. All those little things that we are perfectly capable of doing
right
in a short period of time before they're discharged and we don't see them again for years and years and years and years. Because that's health care. That's what we're here for. We're here to provide the health care. I'm not here to, you know, use judgment or
right.
to victim blame or anything like that. I'm just here to help. And that gets us back into the trusting area for, you know, for victims to know that they can come and talk with us, trust us. We're not going to cause any drama in your life. I'm not going to make reports that you don't want me to report. I'm
yeah.
just here to offer resources and ways to help.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because there is definitely a kind of stigma when it comes to victims of any IPV that, like, obviously you don't want law enforcement involved. But I've never really fully thought about the stigma that comes with healthcare workers as well in that scenario. And I think it's really important that you made it known that you're not going to call the police as well. Because I think a lot of them think that if they come in and that happens, if they were to disclose to you that, like, yes, I am being trafficked, or yes, like, my domestic violence abuser is out there, that you guys are mandated reporters and you would have to immediately call the police.
No, I'm mandated reporters for children.
Yes, absolutely.
And adults over the age of 65. But most of our victims are around the age of 25, 30. I'm not a mandated reporter. Reporting has nothing to do with it. Same with sexual assault. You can come in and get a sexual assault exam. We collect all of your evidence and we send it to holding if you want to involve law enforcement. That way you have the option, because there is no age that you go out of the system or whatever. It's not like,
right.
you know, after
right.
10 years, we won't prosecute anymore. So in West Virginia, it can be held indefinitely. And, you know, 10 years down the road, if you decide, you know, I'm ready to press charges, I'm ready to do something with this now, your evidence can be pulled back out and we've gotten it. We've captured it from that event. So that's something a lot of victims don't know too. You don't have to involve law enforcement.
Yeah. Yeah, we've seen that a lot. And, you know, the more trainings that I've done and the more people I've told, I make it clear that, like, we're only mandated reporters if they're a child or, again, it's an elderly person or someone who has a disability and can't advocate for themselves. But if you're above 18, you're an adult, you get to make that choice for yourself. And I think that it's not as well known. Like, a lot of people just assume that if you go to a rape crisis center or you go to a hospital that you're going to call the police. And then that makes it really hard for people to come in. And it's already obviously extremely hard to come in and talk about it and to even discuss what's happened, let alone when you run that risk of someone potentially reporting you, which we're not going to do. But a lot of people don't understand that.
Right. And I think even with human trafficking, if we're talking about illegal immigrants coming in,
yes,
and their victims, they think that we're going to call ISIS is the big bad word.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't even know what ISIS stands for, let alone have a number for them.
Yeah. You
know, that's not my role. That's not my role. I am healthcare. I'm here to make you healthier. And I always say my goal is that you leave in a better place than when you presented to me. That's my goal.
I love that. That's a beautiful goal. I think that's all of our goal here in this field in line of work. But yeah, especially when it comes to undocumented immigrants or anyone coming in who is worried that we would report to anyone in general, but also it creates a whole nother barrier if there's someone who doesn't have documented status, because you run the risk of anything. And we want to be able to service anyone who needs it. If you need assistance for domestic violence, sexual violence, human trafficking, stalking, like, we're here. We don't care. We're not going to ask. That's why when people come to us, we don't ask for, like, identification or insurance or anything at the crisis centers, because we're like, we don't need this. Like, we just want to help you. You don't even have to tell us your real name, unless obviously if you decide to report, then you would need it on legal documents. But as far as for us, like, you don't have to even tell us your real name. Like, you can come in and just be open and talk to someone.
Right. And that's perfect. And, you know, one of the biggest things with human trafficking is the handlers. They have said that to the victims so many times. You don't trust law enforcement. You don't trust anybody in the healthcare workers. They're going to cause problems for you. It's just going to make things so much worse. And that's their way of keeping them under their control. And I've noticed another thing that victims are scared of too. Even if they know the fact that, you know, we're not going to call a report on them, we're not calling law enforcement, but their big concern is, what if they have children?
Right.
Are their children going to be taken away from them if they disclose everything that's going on in their home? So that's another barrier to getting help too, and to talking about it, is because they fear for their children.
Yeah, so that's definitely a barrier we see often. And obviously we are mandated reporters when it comes to children. So, and there are ways around that, as far as, like, if they don't tell us their real name, then we don't have an actual name to report. Right. Like, we'll make a report, but, like, we don't have your actual name. Or if they come in and they talk hypothetically about the situation or something, you know, like, my friend has these children and I want to help them. And then it ends up actually being them. And of course, once we know, we would have to report if it's an abusive situation and there are children in the home. But that also creates its own barrier. So now you have people who are undocumented who don't want to seek services, or parents who don't want to seek services, because if you're a victim of human trafficking, if your partner, like, what we see mostly is familial trafficking, whether that be someone trafficking their child because they need drug money, or a partner trafficking their spouse because they want to for power and control, or because they need money for something, you know, it creates a huge issue, because they obviously probably don't have any access to their own income. If they're being trafficked, then, like, that's what's happening. That's their job per se. But a lot of people, if we're looking at other victimizations like domestic violence or sexual violence, they're probably not, they don't have a job. So they don't have access to income. They don't have a car. They're being watched constantly. Like, they can't just come report
Right.
because they run that risk.
And you saying all of that, that is why you and I are in the positions that we're in. I want people to know that there is help out there.
Right.
There's resources. And I always tell my patients, you know, I can control and help you all that I can inside of the hospital setting, because that's where I'm based. But once you leave here, I have to step out of the picture and somebody else gets to take over. You, the Empowerment
Right.
Center.
Right.
But I say they have information and they have knowledge of so many more outside resources that I could not even compute. You know, that's not my job.
Right.
That,
right.
that's your job. I'm going to do that warm handoff to you. And there are so many services out there for victims that they don't know about. So just getting you all in to talk to victims, to offer those services and to give that little, you know, light of hope, to be
right.
like, there is a way out of this, you know, and it's going to be baby steps for them. Cause you know,
Absolutely.
We know that it's not going to get better when we step in, it's going to get worse before it gets better. So just offering all of the resources we possibly can. And I'm sure there are tons more out there that we're not even talking about.
Right.
That even
right.
You do warm hands off too.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to get you connected with this type of service. But it all starts with having one person and then follow the chain to the next person to get those resources and to help victims. Because we do have, Berkeley County is phenomenal. So is Jefferson County, for all of the resources and the help that is out there in the county that is willing to step up and help these victims.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest barriers that comes with human trafficking in general, because obviously they're not going to be told that these resources exist, but there's so much kept from them that they can receive help with. So even for like people who are afraid to report because they have kids and they don't want them to end up with the abuser. And then, you know, they show up with you and then you refer them to us. And then we're able to refer them to places like West Virginia Legal Aid, which is free. Mm-hmm. And they can help them with services for like custody battles or like single parent services that we have connections to, you know, for like single moms or single dads. And there's so many more resources out there that if they would just come and talk to us a little bit, they don't have to report. They can just have a conversation where we can be like, and this conversation could be as simple as like, I need some resources to help with my situation. Cool, here. Like, you don't even have to work with us. If you don't want our services, we have connections to other services.
Right. And that's the goal of the handler. They want their victims to be isolated.
Yeah.
They don't want them to know of services. They don't want them to meet people like you or me. And that's how it happens, is they keep them isolated. Then they start to control everything they do and think, so that it's harder for them to reach out for services.
Absolutely. Are there any other outreach efforts that you're doing this month other than the Red Dot program?
Not for like other healthcare workers, not for outreach to the community. Now for myself, I mean, there's a wealth of information online right now for this month for human trafficking. There's webinars every day. There's Zoom meetings every day. I'm
Absolutely.
Attending as many as I possibly can, because, you know, some deal with different types of situations. Some might be just for immigrants and how we deal with that. Some might be for children and sex torsion and all those types of things. So as far as the month of January, I mean, you could just Google anything and
yes.
webinars and Zoom meetings are going to pop up. I know you all are hosting a lot of them for the month, just for the public. So that's a lot of my outreach. My other big outreach, I joined the Rotary. That was one of my year goals. And I just feel they're a great organization for community outreach.
Yes.
And, you know, service above self type of thing. So I'm hoping to do, they've historically in the past helped us a lot with our SANE program, as far as, you know, getting us, you know, fidget toys for kids or adolescents, those type of things. So they're a big supporter of our program, and I want to continue that. And I know that we've already talked a lot this year about human trafficking and what we can do with that. So we're hoping to even go that avenue with going with the Rotary to spread the word about human trafficking more to the community.
Nice.
Hospital a little bit. So that's going to come, I think, you know, again, baby steps, but it's a start. I joined, and, you know, we're going to start doing a little bit now towards human trafficking awareness.
That's great. Yeah, the Rotary has been amazing, especially for us here at Epic. They always are willing to help with anything, and there's a lot of people in this community that are willing to donate money to help with our services, which has been such a blessing. So we're really
Oh,
thankful for
yeah.
them.
Yes. I think we have it when I go to other parts of the state. I think, the Empowerment Center, the Rotary, everybody is just so much more active in our area. And I
Yes.
see so, and it hurts my heart when you go into small counties like Mingo County or
Yeah.
those types of areas where they don't have the services that we have. So, I'd like to see
Yeah.
that spread through West Virginia. Telesane for me is the best option right now, but
Yeah,
at the start.
that would be amazing to see that happen, just because, like we talked about, like it's this is West Virginia up here, but it's a different kind of culture up here. We live in a different world. When you go down there, it's different. You're in the middle of Appalachian culture, and there's this stigma that comes with living in West Virginia of like, do it by yourself. Like, you don't need help, and you should be able to do it on your own. And that is so hard. It creates so many barriers for people in fields like you and I are in, because we need to have community connections in order to successfully service these people. Like, we cannot do it by ourselves. We have to work together.
Very well said. I'm glad you said that at the whole motto of, do it yourself, because we do have to get past that.
Yeah.
And just knowing where our resources are is where we need to start.
Yeah. I would love to see more happen in middle or southern West Virginia, just because they need help down there, and they don't want to ask for help, or the it's seen as bad if you need help. But like, you do, and that's okay. Like, we want to help, but you have to be willing to work with the hospitals and the right crisis centers. But we also need more funding for those places in order to get the help that they need down there. I just went to a prevention summit yesterday, and we talked about how prevention education looks different in each of the counties. So like, all of the counties that, like, there's 12 rape crisis centers in West Virginia, and most of them have prevention funding. So there are like 9 out of the 12 centers that have prevention funding, but we're all doing different things. So like, West Virginia as a whole, the three top prevention categories that they feel from the demographics and from the reports and everything that they got that need the most sexual violence prevention are people with disabilities, children, and then college age. So they don't have to be in college, but 18 to 24 is definitely a focused target population to try and decrease sexual assaults. But within that, there's all these subsets, and it looks different for every county. So the prevention efforts that we're all doing are different. Some of them are the same, obviously, but they're all a little different. And I do feel like we do like more prevention in a way up here, in a way, because we have more resources up here to do that. Like, we're a rich, resourced place. Like, in Jefferson and Berkeley, we have connections with the hospitals. We have connections with Jefferson County Community Ministries for homeless. I've worked with the senior centers recently to work with like people who are elderly and who need, because they also need prevention training as well. They need education. And we try to get in the local schools and the local universities, and then we're reaching out to all these different places. And when you're in more of a rural area, first of all, there's not very many places to reach out to. Like, they might not even have senior centers down there, or local universities, or like, there's populations that they're not even able to service because there isn't a space for them. There are elderly people down there. There are college age people down there. But is there a place that they're all hanging out that you can provide resources to? Not really.
And sexual assault is such a taboo thing. I've noticed that when I tell people, what I do and I talk about sexual assault, it's when I say human trafficking is where people are like, oh, what? Wait a minute, what? And
Yeah, that's when they pay
that's
attention.
when they want to hear more. And I have found that a lot of my community partners, as soon as they want more human trafficking training, they
Yep.
want more knowledge on human trafficking and what it looks like here in our county. That is one of the biggest requests that I have over anything is just human trafficking, human trafficking, human trafficking. And I get it because it's the buzzword. People are curious about it and they want to know more about it, which is a good thing. But I have to
Absolutely.
be able to teach that in an appropriate way. I don't want to be able to teach it like this is, what people think and what they imagine it is. I want to be like, no, this is what it looks like in our area.
Great. Well, and we've obviously also gotten a lot of human trafficking training interest as well, because that is the buzzword right now. But what people don't seem to be making the connection to is that human trafficking awareness is sexual violence prevention.
Right.
Like, that's what we're doing when we're talking about human trafficking. But if we
Yeah.
just mention sexual violence prevention, a lot of people are like, yeah, I don't think I need that. I don't want
Yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And it's like, but you do. You do.
Yeah. I
It's
mean, how
still.
many times you and I talking today have we started with human trafficking and veered off right to sexual assault or
Right.
strangulation? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a window to open it up. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I think the only other question I had was specifically for the Red Dot program. I know it's not been up and running a lot, so you may not have an answer for this because it's a newer program, but have there been any barriers that you've come across so far specific to this program that you have to get past or that you need to like work around when it comes to like the pilot program at Berkeley?
So, I mean, initially there was the barrier of getting the appropriate people trained. And then we were thought about, okay, what if we miss it? Then who gets it next? Let's train them too. Those type of things. And then our biggest barrier was IT, because we want to abide by HIPAA. We want to,
Right.
when we're in these charts and everything, of how can we do this so that we are abiding by HIPAA. And not everybody's just looking in the charts for things. So that was our biggest barrier, is getting everything done through IT. And since this is just happening at Jefferson and Berkeley Medical Center, then we were like, well, okay, we need to inform the rest of the healthcare workers throughout the state, because if someone comes to another hospital and they see
Yeah.
that somebody talked to them about this, they're going to wonder what it is. So we want to at least, so what we're doing is we send out this CBL to the rest of the state, to the providers, to say, this is, if you see this on somebody's chart, for instance, this is what it is and this is what it means. And just know that the patient would like to be, by themselves when they're assessed, type of thing.
Right.
So that was our biggest barrier, is just thinking about all the little things that you don't think about initially.
Yeah.
People bring those up to you, which is what we want to happen. We want people to be like, think outside the box and be like, okay, what if this happens? Well, okay, let's prevent that too. So
Yeah.
just little things like that. And I've explained to all of the staff that this is still just a pilot. These
Right.
policies and procedures are not hard stops right now. If you miss something, don't beat yourself up over it. There's nothing you've done wrong. It's just a way for us to try and rework the program so that it works better. So
Yeah.
that's what we're going to spend this year doing, is just making sure that we've covered all of the little holes that we need to cover.
I love that. And is there anything more that like we could be doing at Epic to help with the hospitals with human trafficking awareness, or anything that you feel like the community could be doing different to help with human trafficking awareness or sexual violence prevention as far as it comes to any services that you're providing?
I think for the community, one of the biggest things that I talk about is that we have that national human trafficking hotline.
Right.
And people are always like, should I call that? And what does that mean? And it doesn't mean that I'm calling into the hotline and saying, Susie May came to the hospital, here's her date of birth, and this is everything that happened. That would be a HIPAA violation.
Right.
What it means is I'm just calling in and saying, I had this patient, and this was the situation that she was in or he was in, and I just found it suspicious. Okay, because what that does is then, that same kind of situation may have happened in Huntington or Charleston, in
Yeah.
Wheeling, and then they can start piecing things together to make some kind of a case against that without any victim involvement. So I want the community to know that, there is a national hotline. You can call that in. You can call it in anonymously. And you don't have to give victims names or anything. You just report a situation that you find suspicious, that you may think is human trafficking. That's one of the biggest things I think that we could do to boost awareness in our area, because there may be things that we're not even thinking about that may be suspicious. And who knows, it could be happening throughout the rest of the state. And they could use that tip to start piecing things together.
I couldn't agree more. We've always lived by a if you see something, say something type of
Yes.
standpoint, and it's better to be wrong than to have not reported something, and that person really needs help. And
Absolutely.
the next time somebody realizes they need help after you've realized it might be a year from now or longer. Like it's not like, oh, well, I didn't say something, but I'm sure tomorrow someone will see something and say something. Like that person might not be seen again for a really long time, if ever. So it's important that if you notice something that you can call the hotline and explain it because it could save someone's life.
Right, exactly. So I want everybody to know of that national, the Polaris, the National Human Trafficking Hotline. And all of, when you call the hotline, basically what they do is they send that tip to wherever it came from. So if it came from someone in West Virginia, they're sending it to law enforcement officials in West Virginia
Right.
to say, this is the tip that we got. They're kind of like the central hub to sort those tips out. So that's all basically it is.
Well, I think we covered everything. So, do
Okay.
you have any questions for me, or is there anything you feel like we missed?
I don't. I just really want to emphasize the support that the Empowerment Center gives us at the hospital. I know that since we've started calling more, you guys are getting a lot more calls, and I appreciate
That's okay.
that because not every call is sexual assault. It's not always me calling you for an exam.
Right.
We have a lot of other instances where we just call you in just for the support. And again, sometimes we're like, oh, do we call it? And I don't want to, it's 3 in the morning. I don't really want to bother somebody. But, still, you guys are still there at 3 in the morning to come in and help us with the situation. And again, it may just be offering resources, and that's your goal. But
Right.
if we can continue to get you connected with patients that need resources, that's our goal. And I am forever grateful for all of you who come in at 2 and 3 in the morning, just answer a call just to come in and give some resources, because that, again, that it's a small window of opportunity.
Right,
We don't have these
right.
patients for long.
Yeah, I mean, we're so thankful for our partnership with you. We're so grateful for everything that you do for this state in general, for anyone who needs a sane examiner. Like the fact that we have this program at all and we're able to successfully run it is because of you. And you do such amazing work. And we're so thankful for you. We're thankful for all of the sane nursing examiners. We're thankful for our partnerships with the local hospitals because if we're not working together, we're not going to solve it. Like we
Right.
have to have a partnership. So without
Right.
you guys, so a lot of our cases probably wouldn't even be possible.
Right. And how many times do I just call over there and be like, I just have a question about something. Can you
Right,
just help me out? Help me
which is
think through
fine.
this?
We want to
Yes.
answer the questions.
Yeah. So it's a tool in my back pocket that I am very grateful for. Yes.
Well, we are equally as thankful for you.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Epic Echo. To suggest topic ideas, guest recommendations, or even just to ask questions you'd like us to answer on air, please find us on social media at the Epic Echo Podcast or on our website at epicwv.org/epic-echo.